refugees, asylum seekers, and undocumented immigrants who have faced that violence and trafficking before the point of entry as well, and then get here seeking help and don't receive it because they don't qualify. Or honestly, they're maybe just not even assessed, and they're not receiving the proper assessments to see if they could qualify for some of the services or other services for violence, victims of violence anyway.
January is National Slavery and Human Trafficking Prevention Month in the United States. So, I interviewed Dr. Melissa Torres to discuss human trafficking in the American context. She holds a PhD in social work and works at the University of Texas as a director of human trafficking research at Baylor College. Dr. Torres is one of the authors of the first report linked in the episode's description, which estimates that 313,000 people are victims of human trafficking in Texas alone. She is also the vice president of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, or WILF. As their vice president, she focuses on intersectionality and protecting displaced Latinos in the Americas. In November 2020, she co-wrote recommendations for the USA's Universal Periodic Review, or UPR. For those unfamiliar, the UPR is a process where each member state of the UN declares what actions they have taken to improve human rights in their countries. The report showcases that the militarization of the U.S.-Mexican border and the zero-tolerance policy of the Trump administration have led to the broadening of human rights abuses. In this episode, we'll explore how these connect with human trafficking. Before we start, I must clarify two things. First, human trafficking and modern slavery are global phenomena that affect all countries. Indeed, an estimated 40 million people live in modern slavery today. In this episode, we focus on citizenship, migration, and peace in the U.S.-Mexican border context alone. But there is much more to unpack. Second, the views expressed by Dr. Torres are her own.
And first, I would like to ask you about your experience, how it relates to human trafficking, and how did you get here?
So I actually got involved in anti-trafficking work through my years of working in HIV and AIDS testing and counseling. So for a few years, I was working as an HIV tester here in the county and one of the very limited Spanish speakers. So I was hired and contracted by several agencies to do outreach to the Latino community and trying to, quote, pick up Hispanic numbers, end quote, whatever that means. So doing outreach into the Latino community. So I happened to stumble across a lot of people that were doing sex work, and that was their big risk. You had to present a risk for HIV in order to qualify for a free test. So then they started, you know, in talking about their risk, they started telling me about their friends and, you know, telling me, can you go over here and offer this to someone else? And it just snowballed. I started to really know the community, become familiar with a lot of high risk areas. And I eventually ended up working once a week out of a strip club offering services. I always joke that my first office was in a porn booth because I was offering HIV tests out of there. And there was a couple of strip clubs in that area. And so the girls would come during their break and get tested. And at that time, I wasn't very familiar with I should say I didn't have the language for sex trafficking or human trafficking in general. So at work, we were supposed to bring, you know, trends that we were seeing or new things out in the streets that we saw or learned back to work to discuss. So I talked to my boss about it. And a couple of days later, he asked me if I knew what human trafficking was. And being from the border, I'm originally from the U.S.-Mexico border, I had thought it had to do with smuggling, and he said no, started giving me some things to read. And at this point is when I started my master's in social work and I left my job. So when I started my master's, I started looking into human trafficking, and my first internship was at an HIV clinic where I was again doing testing and counseling. And this time they asked me to do outreach through their transgender organization. The clinic that I was at had like a support group that had grown into a foundation for transgender services. And they said, you know, we have a lot of immigrant transgender Latinas that are out in the streets that need HIV tests, but, you know, we can't work with them. We don't speak the language. So I started going out with them, and those are the first, that's the first group who really taught me, this is how you can tell who's doing sex work. This is how you can tell who's being trafficked. This is how you can tell who's been smuggled in. A lot of transgender sex workers took me to different areas and cantinas and neighborhoods and showed me the ropes and introduced me to other sex workers. And I started learning more, started getting involved more in labor trafficking because I was working with the men there at the cantinas as well. And then it just grew from there. So that it's been over 13 years now.
Wow. And when you mention the U.S. and Mexico border, can you expand a little bit on how immigration and citizenship are related to human trafficking within the Texan context?
Yeah, it's one of the trickiest things working at the border is having to decide who's been trafficked to the border at that point when they actually get there and haven't entered the U.S. And what we call, you know, the traída, usually when they're working with a smuggler, a coyote, or, you know, having faced any kind of threats along the way, if there's been any kind of exploitation, trafficking, or any sort of violence that they faced in that journey. And that's obviously for undocumented entry into the U.S. versus the trafficking that happens here. So the federal law, the Trafficking Victims Protection Act here in the United States, focuses on trafficking. If you're an immigrant here in the United States, you have to have been trafficked in the U.S. in order to be considered a victim of human trafficking here in the United States and receive those services. Mm-hmm. So I work with several people, having worked with refugees, asylum seekers, and undocumented immigrants who have faced that violence and trafficking before the point of entry as well, and then get here seeking help and don't receive it because they don't qualify, or honestly, they're maybe just not even assessed and they're not receiving the proper assessments to see if they could qualify for some of the services or other services for violence, victims of violence anyway. So we do deal with a lot of people who have had both, if they came in undocumented or through other circumstances, because I've worked with so many people who have come in through visas or other legal means, but and then they showed me the documentation and it's either one, not real, or it's not the visa that they were told that they had. For example, a lot of them say that they have a visa that allows them to work. And when I review the papers, they don't, but they're under someone who is, who paid for them to get a tourist visa and then is trafficking them here for labor, telling them, you know, I sponsored your worker's visa. So that means legally you work for me. Because that is part of like HB1 visa type situations. So they just preyed on that ignorance of what type of documents that they need or the rights that they have with those documents. And so a lot of them think, not a lot, but a few that I've worked with have thought, you know, I am here legally. And when they show me the papers, it's not the situation they thought it was. So it's really difficult to, when you're a mental health, not myself, I'm not a clinician, but when you're a mental health provider, like the team that I work with, and you're trying to work with victims who have trauma, but the trauma necessarily isn't like considered qualified here by legal standards in the U.S., you know, it's a difficult situation having to say, okay, we know what this is. We know what this looks like. You have the same trauma, same experience as someone else who might have experienced it here in the U.S. also, but under legal standards, you know, you don't fall under these protections or can't receive these services.
And what do you think that are some of the steps that in that scenario could be taken forward by either the American government or by either advocates with these people to improve their situation and to build peace building from that point of view?
I think we have a difficult road in terms of undocumented immigration into the U.S. or asylum and refugee, or I should say just asylum seeking into the U.S. because of violence. In the last 2 years, the current administration removed certain qualifications for asylum seeking based on violence, specifically domestic violence, gender-based violence. So if you were fleeing a violent situation at home and trying to come to the U.S. To seek asylum because you didn't have a place to stay in your country. You didn't feel safe, sort of almost like an interpersonal persecution, right? In that case of asylum, that's already been removed before people could seek that. So in these terms, if you've been trafficked, and you know, we see it even here with domestic trafficking in the U.S., if you've been trafficked and you're trying to escape your trafficker and you can't, you know, where's a safe place for you to go? Where else do you have these options? And so, I mean, there's a lot of things that need to be changed, and and not just for immigrants and not just at the border. You know, TVPA also has sections that address our work abroad. But it's the immigration process itself, even, I hate to use these terms, but legally, going through the process legally, is really complicated, difficult, and expensive. And those barriers for someone who's already vulnerable for trafficking just exacerbate those situations. And then even once you're in the process, there are other barriers. Like, for example, you know, having to wait for one of the biggest risks one of the biggest vulnerabilities that people have for trafficking is economic drivers, poverty. You know, if you're promised these jobs, if you're promised work or these opportunities that you don't have anywhere else, you know, that makes you susceptible to these predators who are coming and preying upon that. And knowing that you don't have any other options and taking control of that. And then let's say you get here, you get assistance, you're able to stay in the U.S. For whatever status you're looking for, but you still have to wait all these months to get any kind of permit to work legally in the U.S., then you're back in that position that made you vulnerable in the first place. And I've seen it so many times with so many clients and study respondents that's the situation, that, you know, they feel they get this assistance down, they have this protection from the U.S. government, but then they're put in this risk again. And again, if their trafficking happened here, then their trafficker is here. And if they haven't been caught, you know, a lot of times they reach out to them again, knowing like, yeah, maybe they're protected, but they're in a situation again that they're not protected from poverty and need that opportunity, you know, quotes again. So there's a lot of different situations where we need to make changes, both in identifying and responding and assisting, and most especially in preventing. So we work with a lot of people here as well with Know Your Rights, more particularly in labor trafficking. Mm-hmm. And informing them about sex trafficking as well. The issue with education that we see, and the reason we focus a lot on grassroots work, is education at the federal level, education through a lot of media, education through a lot of like international organizations, mm-hmm. is really focused on sex trafficking women and girls. It's a gendered situation. Mm-hmm. Human trafficking itself is a gender topic. And not to say that we don't need that lens included, but it shouldn't be the only and main one. Mm-hmm. It dismisses the larger part of victims of human trafficking worldwide. Labor trafficking is far more prevalent than sex trafficking, and we don't give it any attention. We don't focus on identifying the victims. There seem to be men and boys, and they're not a priority. That's why we really focus on doing that outreach, letting everyone know that they're susceptible and you know, what their vulnerabilities are, what the risks are, you know, once they're in those situations or once they meet certain people or hear certain things, you know, identifying those red flags of the risk, and letting them know what their rights are as well.
What does your work entails with healing for survivors?
I think the main thing in working with survivors is letting them know that what happened to them and their individual experience happens more than they know, you know, like it happens across, but also knowing, you know, as a scientist on the other side, it's not the only way things happen. So there's, you know, there's a balance there in any kind of, situation where you're working with someone who has faced trauma and violence, you know, and it doesn't even have to be trauma from violence. Any kind of trauma, you focus on the situation, it's completely real to you, especially when you have, you know, people who are dealing with like post-traumatic stress disorder could have these flashbacks and it feels real again all of a sudden, even though they're in the middle of a supermarket, you know. It's so overpowering sometimes that you just feel like this is the only experience and that's the focus. And so you need to validate that this was real. This is what happened to you. And that is an experience that only you lived in the way that you lived it. And so how do we work through that? In working with survivors individually, that's the goal. In working with survivors in research and including them as part of the response and getting their advice, you know, having boards and advisory boards or consultants on research or respondents, that part has to balance what was your experience and how does this tie into trafficking overall, you know, to the experience of the next survivor and the next survivor who each individually feel like their experience was, you know, what they want to address and what they want to help. How do we bring all of those together? So I think there's a lot of different ways in working with survivors in research and working with survivors individually in services. The most important thing is acknowledging what happened to them is valid, you know, their experience and their reaction is valid, and they also deserve whatever means they want to get through that at whatever time they want to get through it. How to live with it, or, you know that it exists, or how to try to get past it.
After the conversation you've heard, Dr. Truss emphasized that labor trafficking, which is the most common type of human trafficking, is under-discussed. For example, in Texas, 74% of the victims of human trafficking fall under the labor trafficking category. The major contributor to migration is the lack of opportunities in their home countries. These migrants can make significant contributions to their host country and deserve to have their fundamental human and labor rights respected. On the other hand, restrictive immigration policies and complicated and expensive legal processes turn migrants into easy targets for human traffickers throughout their trajectory. Much more political will, leadership, policy, and legal reform, not to mention less scapegoating, is needed to maximize the positive aspects of migration and minimize the negative. Those steps are essential as we try to tackle the crime of human trafficking and bring justice to survivors. I'm Fernanda Bernardo, and this is Peace in a Pod.